Hello, welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. From Flagstaff, I'm your volunteer reader, Deborah McFadder, with excerpts from Yes Media, a nonprofit independent publisher of solutions journalism. Last time that we were together, we were reading an article called A Violence Prevention Helpline for Those Who Want to Change, written by Claudia Boyd Barrett and first published February 20th, 2025. We were reading about a group out of Massachusetts called A Call for Change that offers a helpline which perpetrators of domestic violence can call anonymously, and also about another group called Black Women Revolt Against Domestic Violence, and a director there named Pamela Tate, who was quoted saying, "Batterers' intervention programs are because you've already battered. You've already been found guilty of battering. They send you to a class," Tate says. "This is, I'm voluntarily calling. Maybe I can talk this out and figure out how to de-escalate and not cause harm, because I don't want to harm my partner." The question remaining for Tate is, will enough people who need the help actually call for the helpline? Ben Withers, who works for STAND, for Families Free of Violence, an organization in Contra Costa County, California, that runs a batterer's intervention program, said he was already recommending the helpline to people in his program to call for extra support between classes. Withers said he hoped the helpline would steer other people who could benefit from anti-violence programs like his to enroll in classes voluntarily. A photograph again, this time, of a woman in a brightly decorated white jacket, but it looks like people have painted all over it in almost like graffiti design, and she's leading some physical exercises with people who have their arms raised high as if they're breathing deeply. Currently, only about 10% of people in the batterer's intervention program are there because they want to be, he explained. "I'm excited for the people calling," he says. "The helpline creates an avenue for people to enter services outside the carceral system." The Alliance for Boys and Men of Color plans to do additional trainings about the helpline and is fundraising to support expanding its hours and responder staff in California. Ultimately, organizers said they hope to get state government support for the effort. Meanwhile, for American, the abuse she experienced as a child pushed her to pursue a career working with and advocating for survivors of domestic violence. Although she said she never succeeded in persuading her father to change his ways, she's hopeful her work as a responder for A Call for Change will break the cycle of abuse for other families and intimate partners. To be able to do this for somebody else's parent, somebody else's partner, is deeply healing for me too, she says. To reach A Call for Change, call 877-898-3411 or email help@callforchangehelpline.org. The helpline is open from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time every day of the year. It's free, anonymous, and confidential. Language translation is available. After-hours callers can leave a voicemail and receive a call back within 24 hours. For more information, visit acallforchangehelpline.org. If you or someone you know is experiencing domestic violence, you can also contact the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-7233 for support and referrals, or text START to 88788. Information on local domestic violence programs can be found using this online tool. For Native Americans and Alaska Natives, the Strong Hearts Native Helpline at 1-844-7-NATIVE. That's 1-844-762-8483. Provides 24/7 confidential and culturally appropriate support and advocacy for survivors of domestic and sexual violence. A chat option is available through their website. This story was produced in collaboration with the California Health Report. From the analysis section, this article is entitled A Beautifully Wicked Approach to Disability by Valisa Thompson, first published February 27th, 2025. Before we read the article, we have a still shot from the movie Wicked that has the two actresses, Marissa Bode and Cynthia Erivo. And if you have seen the movie, Marissa plays the character that is in a wheelchair, and Cynthia plays Elphaba. Despite being pitied for the color of their skin or wheelchair use, the film's characters don't let society define them or their power. When I went to see Wicked, which was up for 10 Academy Awards on Sunday, I wasn't sure what to expect. Of course, the film's inescapable buzz piqued my interest, but I was mostly driven to the theater by my curiosity about how sisters Elphaba and Nessa Rose Throp would be portrayed. I was specifically interested in Nessa Rose, played by Marissa Bode, a disabled character because she's being played by an actual wheelchair user, a rarity in casting. However, as the movie progressed, I shockingly began relating more to Elphaba, Cynthia Erivo, than Nessa Rose, though I am also a wheelchair user. While Elphaba and Nessa Rose have the same mother, Elphaba was conceived when their mother has an extramarital affair with a man who gives her a green elixir to drink. From the moment Elphaba is born with green skin, her father, Frex Spar, played by Andy Nyman, rejects her and begins treating her like an outsider. He even delegates her child-rearing to an anthropomorphic bear named Dulcie Bear. At the same time, Frexbar dotes relentlessly on Nessa Rose, his biological daughter, and discourages Elphaba from using magic in public. Elphaba is treated as an outcast because of her green skin, which the film regards as a disability. Whenever Elphaba encounters a person for the first time, they often visibly gasp because her skin is so different from theirs. "Fine, let's get this over with," she always retorts. "No, I am not seasick. No, I did not eat grass as a child. And yes, I've always been green." When Elphaba first meets Glinda, Ariana Grande Butera, and offers this spiel, Glinda says, "Well, I, for one, am so sorry that you have been forced to live with this." She then offers to fix Elphaba's ailment, saying, "It is my intention to major in sorcery, so if at some point you wanted to address the problem, perhaps I could help." Elphaba's green skin, which she does not actually have an issue with, is treated by the people around her as a liability or something worthy of being pitied. The inability of Elphaba's father and classmates to connect with her because of her exterior difference made me recall the many times over the course of my life where I have been prejudged because I use a wheelchair. The hesitation to acknowledge Elphaba's existence is something I've experienced as a black woman with a physical disability. People have judged and misjudged me before they even learned my name or heard me speak. The world isn't different or thoughtful to people whose physical presentations are different. It's painfully familiar for me to be ridiculed before being embraced. I'm always in a cycle of wondering what others think and if they're being genuine. That's a sadness that never leaves, even as I've grown immune to what others think about me. Throughout the film, Elphaba is isolated, which fuels loneliness, another emotion that's particularly resonant. Being the only in your family and community with such a striking difference is a bold act of existing in a world that demands conformity. And yet, despite the fact that Elphaba's stepfather treats her as if she's a burden, she's still incredibly protective of Nessa Rose. When the sisters first arrive at Shiz University, where Nessa Rose is enrolled, an overbearing teacher attempts to push Nessa Rose's wheelchair before she even asks for assistance. When Elphaba sees this transpire, she becomes upset about her sister being infantilized and conjures powerful magic that gains her impromptu admission into Shiz and gets the immediate attention of Madame Morrible, Michelle Yeoh, a professor who begins mentoring her. Elphaba respects Nessa Rose's autonomy, though other people in their lives fail to do so. It's an example of what I call the Good Samaritan Gone Wrong factor, wherein people overextend themselves to help a disabled person without pausing to interrogate why. I am often forced to ask, did the disabled person ask for help? Or are you projecting a sense of helplessness onto them simply because they're disabled? The latter is incredibly ableist, and a disabled person has a right to rebuff that projection. But seeing Nessa Rose deal with ableism in a whimsical film about magic reminded me that ableism is always lurking, even in Oz. But Nessa Rose doesn't reciprocate Elphaba's protective impulse. When Elphaba begins sounding the alarm about anthropomorphic animals losing their ability to speak, she's disregarded and then silenced, an all-too-familiar reality for Black women in our real world who are constantly attempting to save our society from itself and its cruelty. Since Elphaba is also an outlier who's isolated and disbelieved, she's able to easily make the connection between how she's been treated and how these animals are being treated. She understands that the push for conformity is closer than anyone recognizes. This parallel is even more relevant during our current political climate. During the 2024 presidential election, Black voters, especially Black women voters, considered harm reduction while some other voters leaned into it and even relished the harm. It can be isolating to point out injustice, especially when others can't see or don't believe it's happening. As a disabled activist, I know that the people, including your fellow comrades, who should understand the misgivings of the world, will choose a less friction-laden route rather than directly addressing the injustice. When I began speaking out against racism within the disability community, I realized that people with privilege can be severely conflict-avoidant and would rather play nice than hold people accountable. Here's a little reminder that if you miss a program, you can always get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Broadcast info and audio, and then press On Demand. You are tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona, listening to excerpts from Yes Media. Back to our article about Wicked. Glinda, who has built a friendship with Elphaba, knows the animals in Oz are losing their ability to speak. And yet we see her internal conflict around making noise about the issue because she's worried it would negatively impact her social status as the most popular student at Shiz. Like Glinda, people don't confront injustice because they still want access to the resources, money, and connections of those who cause harm. It reflects a scarcity mindset in which one believes an oppressor is worth keeping around because of potential gain. When Elphaba tries to bring attention to the issues occurring in Oz, she's first scrutinized, then disbelieved, and eventually betrayed by the wizard, played by Jeff Goldblum, and Madame Morrible. She's coerced into using her magic to further discriminate against the animals in Oz, and neither Glinda nor Nessa Rose come to her defense. Instead, she's forced to go it alone, even as Madame Morrible calls her a wicked witch across Oz's radio waves. Elphaba is villainized simply because she's attempting to stop powerful people from causing more harm. There's a deep know-your-place tone when Elphaba bucks against the wizard and Madame Morrible. It costs her deeply and shifts the public narrative of who she is. In this moment, we see Elphaba's undesirability in a new light. It's no longer just the micro, her interpersonal relationships. It's now on a macro level, as she's being treated as a political enemy of the state. The parallels in Wicked regarding the ways disability, disabled people, and overall differences among people and other species mirror the hardships people who cannot and do not conform endure in our society. I left the theater better understanding that the people we view as villains may not be the true or only villain in the story. Arrivo breathtakingly embodied Elphaba through every emotion and every moment of rejection and frustration, a commitment that will hopefully continue in Wicked for Good when it's released in November. Ultimately, I hope that our collective understanding of Elphaba expands as we uncover what happened to her, and how her story is further shaped by those who failed to view her with care. About the author, Felisa Thompson, LMSW, is a contributing writer at Yes Media, A macro social worker from South Carolina, she is an expert in discussing the issues that matter to her as a proud, black, disabled woman from the South. Follow her on the socials at Velissa Thompson, that's spelled VilissaThompson. In the news section, we find an article, Immigrant Farm Workers Keep Each Other Safe from the Avian Flu. This was written by Gray Moran, first published February 26, 2025. A drawing starts this article. It shows a room which has blackboards and whiteboards in it and a bulletin board and a number of folding chairs. We can only see the people that are drawn in this picture from the back. So we only see the back of their heads. There's a man at the whiteboard who's writing, and he's writing the letters PPE, and then N95, and then safety gog, and it stops there. It's probably going to be the word goggles. Farm workers in New York are getting informed to protect themselves from the double threats of avian flu and ICE raids. Every month, around 50 dairy farm workers filter into a church basement in western New York after a grueling day of work. They order dinner from a local Mexican or Puerto Rican restaurant and settle in to discuss how to organize for their rights to a dignified life and workplace under increasingly strained conditions. Under the current Trump administration, the largely immigrant workforce is facing an uptick of attacks on their rights. At the same time, the group is bracing for outbreaks of avian flu on New York dairy farms and working to educate their co-workers on how to stay as safe as possible from the virus. The rapidly circulating avian flu has yet to be detected in New York's dairy herds, but these farm workers, members of Alianza Agricola, a group dedicated to fighting for the rights of dairy workers and their communities, don't want to take any chances. Already detected in New York's wild birds, a range of wild mammals, and multiple poultry farms, the virus could soon hit the state's dairy industry, New York's largest agricultural sector, spanning almost 2,800 dairy farms and employing thousands of farm workers. While the virus is still considered low risk to the general public, it poses a greater threat to dairy workers who directly feed, medicate, and milk the cows from dawn to dusk. So far, nearly all of the 68 human cases of the U.S. outbreak of the virus have been in poultry or dairy farm workers, according to the Centers for Disease Control, CDC. Yet members of Alianza Agricola say that farm workers in their group have not received education or training in their workplaces about how to protect themselves from the virus. This has prompted them to take matters into their own hands. Over the past few months, the group has educated hundreds of other farm workers on how to prepare for avian flu, including by traveling directly to dairy farms and providing education at their meetings. None of the employers have given us any information about this, Luis Jimenez, a dairy farm worker and president of Alianza Agricola, tells Sentient. All of the information I have on avian flu and that we've been able to share with other workers is because we've been able to inform ourselves from other institutions. The CDC has issued interim guidance for employers to protect farm workers and other people working with animals from avian flu, recommending that employers train workers on how to identify the virus and other infection control practices. Yet this guidance is voluntary, without any means of enforcing or even widely distributing it, creating a significant gap in worker protections in New York and across the country. Even in states where the H5N1 virus is already circulating in dairy herds, advocates have observed that dairy farm workers lack basic training and information on the virus. A lot of workers have told us they weren't told anything, which actually really stresses people out. When cows were getting sick, they weren't told why, said Bethany Akator, who directs research and public health programs for the National Center for Farm Worker Health. Many workers were really concerned that they were doing something to make the cow sick, and it caused a fair amount of distress, she added. Providing education to 500 New York farm workers. If the virus were to strike New York's dairy farms, these farm workers, low wage, largely unauthorized workers without health insurance, would be on the front lines. Beyond protecting other farm workers from H5N1, Alianza Agricola's outreach helps prevent the spread of the virus to more farm and wild animals and the rising risk of its spread into the general public if it were to mutate to become transmissible between humans. Farm workers, of course, are the most vulnerable to the disease because they're the ones working with the animals, said Delciana Winders, the director of Animal and Law Policy Institute at Vermont Law School. But then, of course, they don't live in isolated bubbles. They live in large communities. And so when they go out into these communities, they're at the highest risk of spreading the virus to other members of the community. Jimenez says that they've worked with the New York Department of Health, the Cornell Farm Worker Program, and other institutions outside of the state to ensure that their educational materials on the quickly evolving virus are accurate and up to date. This has involved printing and distributing a brochure in Spanish and English, H5N1 guidance for farm workers, to about 500 dairy workers so far, according to Jimenez. The brochure explains how the virus can spread through milk, feces, and other body fluids of the infected animals and provides guidance on how farm workers can reduce exposure to the virus. While Jimenez has encountered some farm workers who have never heard of avian flu, the majority of workers are familiar with it. More frequently, he encounters farm workers who are confused about the public health risks of the virus while not realizing that they are the human population at highest risk of contracting the virus. Other farm workers always tell us that they believe you can't get infected so easily, or that it's like any normal flu. So we tell them that, no, it's different symptoms, and it's very easy to get infected if you work with infected animals, says Jimenez. Now there's a color photograph of someone holding up a brochure that's been printed for the farm workers that shows little diagrams of what they could expect as far as symptoms. Behind the brochure and the person's hands in the forefront of the back of the picture shows a herd of cattle inside their barn. The brochure also includes information on how to identify symptoms of the virus in humans with clear visual graphics, though it also notes that some humans may be infected but asymptomatic. Finally, the brochure provides farm workers with QR codes and links on how they can get tested for the virus through a local health department and receive health services through New York's statewide occupational health clinics. At every meeting, Jimenez says, they pass out the brochures. We tell them, don't forget, we have brochures to be informed about what is happening and what avian flu is, he says. They also host meetings dedicated to discussing the virus, sometimes with speakers like Mary Jo Dudley, the director of the Cornell Farmworker Program, who spoke with the group about how to prepare. They're currently working with Dudley and the New York Department of Health to put out a graphic video with further guidance for farm workers on the virus. Dudley says she fielded questions from farm workers about how they would be able to know if the virus is spreading through cattle, questions that are critical not only to the safety of farm workers, but also to the broader prevention of the virus. There's a lot of questions about how would we detect it if the cows have it? How is it spread? Dudley tells Sentient. So it's spread through milk. So milk can include splatter. Splatter gets into manure. So there's all these different levels. How do you protect people at each level? As H5N1 continues to spread, the answers to these questions are also evolving, particularly as some scientists are concerned the virus may be gaining mutations to become airborne, keeping farm worker communities safe. In addition to the looming threat of avian flu, the recent uptick in raids led by ICE, or Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers, since Trump returned to the White House, has heightened fears and anxieties amongst farm workers. In recent weeks, Dudley says that she has observed both ICE and local enforcement parked directly outside health clinics where New York farm workers would seek care if exhibiting symptoms of the virus. That creates pause, says Dudley. Are you going to try to go into that health center, you know? Dudley has also heard concerns from farm workers about the prospect of government personnel entering farms should there be an outbreak. If there is an event with avian flu, then the first step is that inspectors will come to inspect the herd, she says. Yet in this environment of a heightened immigration enforcement, Dudley says, farm workers are more suspicious of strangers and government officials who come to their workplaces. There's a lot of government vigilance, says Dudley. When you see somebody who you interpret to be a representative of the government, you can't differentiate between what they're there for, which can create fear and confusion. Dudley recommends that dairy operators put a sign in front of the farm entrance that reads, "No visitors allowed for biosecurity reasons," along with a number that any invited visitors can call if they need to inspect or conduct business on the farm. The biosecurity issue isn't a cover. Visitors on farms can increase the risk of tracking avian flu. Jimenez says they've provided virtual and in-person trainings to the local community in western New York on how to respond to ICE raids. Right now, we're in this difficult situation with the new administration, so we're asking allies to be alert, he says. If the police call ICE, I think that the allies can help by looking for people in detention centers, supporting the families, or writing letters saying that the workers are part of the community and they are just working and being good neighbors. Meanwhile, Jimenez plans to keep working hard at his job at a large-scale dairy farm where his role is tending to the calves. The weapon that we use as workers is doing good and responsible work. We are always going to have that as a tool for organizing. Alianza Agricola has won what seemed like an impossible fight before, successfully pushing New York to allow undocumented immigrants to obtain driver's license. While the fights ahead may be even larger, Jimenez has never been one to give in to fear. He plans to keep organizing with other farm workers to prepare for both the risks of immigration enforcement and the avian flu hitting New York dairy farms. The future may be deeply uncertain, but Alianza Agricola is informed and ready. This story was originally published by Sentient. And we are at the end of our time. You have been tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona, listening to excerpts from Yes Media. From Flagstaff, I am your volunteer reader, Deborah McFadder. Thanks a lot for listening.